So the thoughts today will be, I guess, a conglomeration of things having to do with Shlach and Korach and beyond, as I was going around the country, that country, in, you know, assorted planes and U-Hauls and other vehicles. So let's see what we have. The going back to Shlach, the Medrash talks about the power of what's called Shluchei Mitzvah. Right, the Medrash talks about the special chavivus, the special preciousness to Hashem, of shlichei mitzvah shemosrim nafsham b'shluchusam, of emissaries of mitzvah that are moser nefesh in their mission. Now, mesiras nefesh is a phrase that, in its most basic sense, we interpret with a person giving up their life, nefesh being the life force. But many svarim point out that nefesh has a broader meaning. Right, Rashi says when Avram Avinu approaches the people of Ches to ask for a burial place for Sarah, he says to them, "Im yesh es nafshechem, if it is with your souls." What does that mean? Rashi says, "Ritzonchem, your desire." Nefesh means desire. So when you plug that back into the concept of Mesiras Nefesh and Ashlichus, that means a person who sets aside, this is what Svasemis is explaining, your own personal desires, and you devote yourself, what I want is the mission, and the success of the mission, the purpose of the mission, for its own pure motives. Svasemis explains, in the name of his grandfather, that that was the hope. There's a lot of confusion in the beginning of Parsha Shlach. Whose idea was this idea of sending the Meraglim, the spies, to Israel? Right, in Sefer Devarim it says Am Yisrael came and pushed for it. Right, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says this is not something which is good in my eyes. He tells Moshe Rabbeinu, if you want to, you send. But we see in the pasuk there it says Hashem saying Shlach Lecha Anoshim, send. So he says what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did, seeing that there was a flaw in the motivation and approach of this sending of these emissaries to Israel, he turned it into a mitzvah. And if they would have done it entirely for the purposes of that mitzvah, then it could have been pure and it could have been successful. Now, the example of those who did it properly was in the Haftarah of Parsha Shlach. Yeshua, in approaching Eretz Yisrael, also sent Meraglim. And we think, wait, isn't that a really bad idea? Right? We've done that before. And it didn't work out well. So here, it was done in the way which was correct, in which they entirely gave themselves over to that. And that gave them particular protection that we're going to see in a second. The Medrash says, or this is actually in the Gemara, I believe, that says that the cover story that these Meraglim used at the time of Yeshua was that they were kadarim. Kadarim are sellers of clay pots. Okay, now, if anybody has done time on an archaeological dig, most of the time what you're brushing away there with your toothbrush, if you're lucky, right, is not a Coke can from a few years ago, but is a piece of pottery from thousands of years ago. That's what you find, lots of broken pottery. Why is there lots of pottery out there? Because pottery was basically a disposable. Right? This has applications in halacha, and the important message of the clay pot in this chazal, says the Svasemis, is that a clay pot is not valuable for itself, only for what it contains. Only for what it contains. So therefore, that is the metaphor for a shliach, for an emissary who's on the mission who gets it right. Meaning, I live for the mission. I exist for the mission. My own particular jollies or non-jollies in this mission are set aside. I am simply a container. I'm a vessel in order to get the contents to where they're supposed to be. And that gave them such protection that they ended up staying in a very challenging place. They stayed in the house of Rachav HaZona, okay, which again, there are different opinions in the Mefarshim as to whether Zona gets its usual literal translation there, which would mean a woman of ill repute, right? But no matter what, the Gemara in Megillah describes the very profound effect Rachav HaZona had on any man who knew her. She was a woman of incredible beauty, incredible power. And they were able to deal with that very challenging setting unscathed because they were so focused on their mission. When a person focuses on their mission, identifies with their mission, so then they're a shliach. And shlichus, when you're an emissary, that has power that we see in halacha. There's a halachic principle, shlucho shel adam kamoso, that the emissary of a person is like the person himself. Okay, there are a variety of different applications. One of the ones which the Gemara later tells us not to do, but technically could be done, is if you really don't want to deal with the whole thing of dating, and you have a friend who's much more capable at that, you could make him a shliach. Right? You say, I hereby empower you to go be mekadesh an isha for me, to go betroth a woman for me. You understand these things much better than me. I trust you. Go pick me a good one. And he goes out there and he meets a young lady at the ice cream shop or something and says, hi, not for me, just I have this friend. Here's a brief profile and a photograph. He's a really good guy. Would you like to get engaged to him? And she says, okay. So you call her two witnesses. You give her a ring. Hareat mekudeshes to my friend Shlomi. B'tabazu kedas Moshe v'Yisrael. That works, okay? Chazal saying not to do it, but it works because once you have been empowered as the shliach, as the emissary of your friend, that's as if you're him. So the Shem Yishmuel brings from his father, the Avnei Nezer, the first Sochet Shavu Rebbe, that's really the power in all mitzvahs that we do. Who made us, who empowered us to do mitzvahs? It's not a hard question because we say it every time or many times we do a mitzvah. Asher, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher kidshonu b'mitzvoso v'tzivonu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made you an emissary to do whatever mitzvah you're doing. Therefore, that principle of shlucho shel adam kamosam, that a person's emissary is like themselves, goes even to that extent. With that, he explains there are certain pat phrases, if you tend toward the mystical a little bit, and you want to talk about what we do when we do a mitzvah, we say it's not just the action that we're doing, we're changing things in the olamos ha'elyonim, in the higher worlds. When we do a mitzvah down here, even a very physical action, you put a coin in a tzedakah box, you put tefillin on your arm, that is changing things, transforming things in all of the spiritual worlds that are the root of everything that happens here. And the Avnei Nezer asked, how do I do that? I don't even know where they are. I don't know how to do that. How can I be doing things that I don't know how or what they are? The answer is, you're not working with your own powers. You receive divine powers because of being shlucho shel adam kamoso. That's what we do. There's a cute story about a chassid who wanted to show his Rebbe a newfangled sukkah gadget he got. That he was in a rainy country, and he said, look, Rebbe, he cranked a crank, and with that, a roof came to cover the sukkah. He said, I do that when it rains. Cranked again, and it opened up. He said, when the rain stops, I open it up, my sukkah is dry. Rebbe said, I like that because that's what we're about. We crank things down here, and we move things up there. That's what it means to be a Jew. So this idea of shlichus, when it comes to a mitzvah, is something that's so powerful, and therefore gives a person powers even beyond themselves to resist dangers that otherwise they would fall to. Okay, now this applies to every mitzvah. And the idea of being an emissary, of being a shliach, means that you're not picking and choosing your mitzvahs. As Shem Yishmuel explains this concept, we refer to it on Shavuos, the Pasuk says, Al pi Hashem yachnu, v'al pi Hashem yisou. When Bnei Israel traveled in the Midbar, they went from place to place, but in Halacha, in the Gemara and Erevin, they consider the camping of Bnei Israel all one place, because their place was wherever HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells them to be. It says, so too, a person will do sometimes a mitzvah here, a mitzvah there, he'll do this mitzvah, he'll do that mitzvah, but nonetheless, he's all on the same mission. The format of the mission may change, the place of the mission may change. Nonetheless, that person has that same power with each mitzvah that they're doing. This was, at least in the simple levels, part of the problem of Korach. Rav Lochem b'nei Levi, he says, what do you need more? A Levi had the mission that he was assigned. That mission was very powerful and very honorable. But when a person tries to look at other missions that aren't theirs, and to be dissatisfied and unhappy with the mission that they have, so then they basically lose their lives. Kina, right? Jealousy is described as rekev atzomos kina. Kina is that which rots your bones. Now, the word bones in Hebrew has a multiple meaning. Etzem means bones, but etzem also means your essence. A person who is jealous loses their essence, loses their self, because they're not living their life. They're trying to live another life. The Medrash says that Korach got eaten up by this. It was in one version of the Medrash, it was his wife, and another version it was a friend of his. If you paid attention in Parshas Baaloscha, when Levim became dedicated for their service, they went through a very strange process. Part of it was they removed all hair from their bodies. All hair was removed, including eyebrows, everything. Totally, totally hairless. And then Moshe Rabbeinu picked up each of the Levim, a tenufa. So one version of the Medrash says that Korach came home after this ceremony, and his wife started laughing at him. What happened to you? And he says, well, this is what we did to be a Levi. She says, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do that. He still got his hair. Korach was like, yeah, that's true. And look at how his brother Aaron's dressed up with the big day kahuna. He looks nice, right? You look like a freak. And he says, yeah. And he picked me up like a pile of dung also. That idea of the tnufa, that's the way he described it. So here you have this very honorable and mystical dedication to be a Levi. And in his mind, because he's looking at what someone else did, and with the laughter or the shame induced by someone else looking at it, suddenly that was viewed as something shameful and something that he didn't want to be. Each person is supposed to do the shlichus that they have, the mission that they have, without shame. The Gemara Bavar Basra tells us that when Yeshua took over from Moshe Rabbeinu, Zakenim Sheba Ador, the elders of the generation, those ones who knew Moshe Rabbeinu, they looked at Yeshua, and they said, Pnei Moshe kepnei chama, the face of Moshe Rabbeinu was like the sun. Pnei Yeshua kepnei levona, the face of Yeshua is like the moon. Oila la'osa busha, woe to that shame. Oila la'osa klima, woe to that embarrassment. So the standard explanation of that is that it was hard for them to deal with the shift in generations. There is a concept of Yiridas Hadoros, Moshe Rabbeinu was unique. There's no way that Yeshua could be like Moshe Rabbeinu. And they said, woe to us that we have to go down to this. Isar of Melech Birman brought down, I did not have a chance to recheck who he brought it down from, a different explanation. Yeshua, Chazal tell us, was Moshe Rabbeinu's shamash. He was assistant, and he would do everything, including setting up the seating for the base medrash. So he would take care of the chairs. It may not have been chairs. Machtzalos, I think it was. It was mats that they would sit on. He would do those things. And when Moshe Rabbeinu was told by Hashem to choose Yeshua as his successor, this was quite a surprise to people. And when they saw Yeshua's face after Moshe Rabbeinu transferred this power to him, Yeshua shone like the moon. Here in this explanation, the moon is not so much an idea of a downgrade, but the beauty of the light of the moon is that it has the ability to receive from the sun and then to reflect it to others. And suddenly they saw, we didn't get this. Why didn't we get this? Why is Yeshua the one, the guy who was moving around the chairs, why is he the one who was able to absorb from Moshe Rabbeinu? Because he did that. What stopped us? Busha, klima. We wouldn't set up the chairs in the base medrash. We wouldn't wash the cup in the coffee corner. We wouldn't do these things. We were above that. We were ashamed to do those things. Oy la la osa busha. Woe to that shame. Woe to that embarrassment. That stopped us from being able to absorb the light of Moshe Rabbeinu in being able to shine like Yeshua. So a person who understands their mission and sees their mission is not going to take a look at how does it look in the pictures, how's it going to play on social media, right? How's it going to be? If this is what I have to do, this is what I'm doing, and then that person gets all of the power that you can get from that mission. One of the few enjoyable things about traveling is I try to take a chance to, when I'm going, I know what my powers of concentration are in planes and things, so I try to dip into some biographies of Gedolei Yisrael when traveling. And that's a good thing. So here from Schuster's Book Club is a recommendation, even though it hasn't yet been translated into English. There's a book called Sulam Yaakov, The Ladder of Yaakov. It's about a Rav who passed away last year, of Yaakov Edelstein Zatzal. It was written by a very interesting couple, Yedidya Meir and his wife, Sivan Rav Meir. They're a very well-known couple in Israeli media. And they lived in Rabbi Yaakov Edelstein's town for a few years. And they wrote this book, many, many stories they gathered from many people about him. He typified this approach to the world of mitzvahs. his story in brief, right? You have his father came from Lithuania. His father was a tremendous gaon, and he received a position as the Rav of a small moshava, it was called back then, called Ramat HaSharon. There he educated his two sons, right, first by himself. This was what the Chazon Ish recommended, in a renovated chicken coop. And he brought them up to be tremendous Talmidei Chachamim. The two young Edelstein brothers were among the first students in the Ponovitch Yeshiva that was started up at that time in Bnei Brak. And Rabbi Yaakov was engaged. He was 27 years old, I believe it was, when he was engaged. And he had an apartment in Bnei Brak, and he was going to be continuing on in the kollel of the Ponovitch Yeshiva, where he was one of the rising stars that everyone was turning to. His father passed away before he got married. The people of Ramat HaSharon, who loved his father very much, wanted one of the sons to continue in the rabbinate of that town. He spoke to his rebbeim, and they told him, this is what you should do. And he took on that job, and he embraced it at every level. Ramat HaSharon was not an overly religious town. It was not an overly large town. He put himself into absolutely everything that needed to be done for the rest of his life, for decades and decades, and was tremendously beloved and grew to levels at the same time in Torah and Kedusha to the extent that people would come and consult him from all over the world. He would give a class to little children in shul on Shabbos after the Kiddush. If someone wandered into the shul and wanted to know, asked him, what do I say? I'm not familiar with the davening. He would sit through slowly and show him. A person could come to his house at all hours. A boy from Ramat HaSharon went to a yeshiva high school and he was behind the other kids. He didn't have the background. And someone said, well, if you need help, you could probably call the rabbi. So he ended up calling from the dormitory Rabbi Yaakov Edelstein each night when he had trouble with his homework. And Rabbi Yaakov did his homework with him on the phone. Right? This is the picture of the idea of I embraced my mission. It doesn't matter if it's something that's very big or very small, if it's known or if it's not known. And such a person shines like the moon. Such a person, that's the way to connect to Torah, to absorb Torah. So let's take a look at what we can do with this. The Sfasemis, first of all, expands this beyond the world of the Taryag Mitzvahs himself, but the idea of Shluchei Mitzvahs for anything that becomes a Torah imperative for you to do. Anything you have to do for your health, anything you have to do for earning your living, anything you have to do to take care of your family, also goes into the category of mitzvah, because the Chovos HaLevavos explains that there is no neutrality in spirituality. Something is either positive or negative. Rav Huttner Zatzal used to phrase it, there's no Switzerland in the world of Ruchnius. There's no neutral territory. So those things that you're doing that you have to do that are positive, that's a shlichus. And a person has to have that in his mind. If I'm going to work today, it's an imperative for me to go to work. I'm going to work for Torah reasons. This is part of my mission in life. If I have to take a trip, and I've determined that this is a trip I have to take, that means this is my mission and this is part of my mission. And if a person frames it that way and accepts it that way, then suddenly you tap into those powers that are far beyond what you would usually be able to have. It gives you protection beyond what you would usually be able to have. A person who has to take a business trip to Las Vegas is not going into the same environment that we have here in the yeshiva. But if it's clear that that is the place that he has to go, and he goes accepting it with the understanding, this is a mission that I'm on, and I must fulfill this mission, and I must be loyal to the tenets of the one sending me on this mission, suddenly you do that in an entirely different way. And it can give you the protection like those messengers of Yeshua who went up. I'll tell you an interesting example of this. And again, this is from the world of Rebbes and Hasidim, where the Hasidim are so devoted to their Rebbe, and a Chassid's greatest wish, and so it is nowadays for Talmidim of Rosh Yeshiva also. I just pointed out that nowadays Rosh Yeshivas are Rebbes, Rebbes are Rosh Yeshivas. Everything is mixed together, right? If you can imagine that someone that you revere so much asked you to do something for them, sent you on a mission to a Chassid, that's the greatest joy, that you could do something for your Rebbe. So there's a story they tell about a Chassid who was going to be taking a business trip to a place that would probably offer some spiritual challenges. Let's call it Paris. I don't know if that is exactly what it was. And his Rebbe, the Ger Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael, in speaking to him before the trip, he asked him, he said, could I ask you to do me a favor on this trip? Chassid was beside himself. He says, yes, please, Rebbe, anything. He says, okay, here's what I need. I would like you to find for me a flashlight which is very small, but also very powerful. Okay? The most powerful it can be, but also as small as can be. Get it? I got it, Rebbe. I will do my best. And in his travels, each place he was trying to speak to the people in the know in the world of flashlights. Right? He was going, he was trying them, he was doing, he was seeing. Finally, he comes back to Israel, goes running, gets online to go into the Rebbe. He presents it. Rebbe, I have this. I've spoken to everyone. The smallest, most powerful flashlight known to man. So the Rebbe opened the drawer, which was full of small and very powerful flashlights, and he tossed it in. He says, fool, he said, you think I need a flashlight? I wanted you to remember you had a Rebbe. And that was something that changed and transformed and protected this man on his mission as he went. But really, everyone has that because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one sending us on our business trips, or on our health trips, or even on our vacation trips, or to the gym, or for a walk, or to visit a relative, or each of these things that we do. And if we see that and sense it and remember it, then we have that protection. I want to share a story that's quite subtle, but illustrates this very well. Try to ride along with this. There's a great teacher of Torah in America. His name's Reb Moshe Wolfson Shlita. Right? One of the oldest of the Mashgichim, the Mashgich of the Yeshiva Torah V'das. And many, many, many people count themselves as Talmidim of Rav Wolfson. Now, he started off as a first grade Rebbe. He taught first grade in the Yeshiva Torah V'das, which starts from kindergarten. And he loved it. He loved that job. He said he threw himself into it entirely, to the extent that when he would dream at night, he would dream about the classroom. He would dream about projects he would do with the kids. He would dream about the games. This he was telling to a group of his Talmidim off the cuff and explaining the Gemara that says that most dreams come after what you think about in the day. Okay? Most dreams come after what you think about during the day. He said, and it happened one year that the summer came and I got this terrible cough and I got laryngitis. I couldn't speak. And September was approaching, the beginning of the school year. I had no voice. I went to the principal and I said, what do I do? And he said, you're a great teacher, but you can't teach first grade with no voice. I'm sorry. He said he was newly married. He had to make a living. He didn't know what to do. He had a friend who connected him up with a watch repair business in Manhattan. There was somebody in the old days who used to not throw out watches. He used to repair a watch, a very painstaking business with the gears and the jewels, etc. And he mentioned in the shir, he says, so that year I repaired watches, and when I slept, I dreamt about watches. I dreamt about gears, I dreamt about all these things. So this was told over by his Talmud, Rav Moti Finkelman, who's the Mashgiach in the Yeshiva Or HaChaim in Queens. He spoke here a couple times. He's a cousin of Rabbi Goldschmidt, who teaches here Wednesday night. He says, here's what I got from that side note in the shir. His dream was to be a teacher of Torah. And he loved teaching children. He never dreamed about watchmaking. But that year, it became clear to him that that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted him to do. He had to do that. He had to support his family. That was the place where he was sent to do it. And therefore, he said, well, that's my mission. And if that's my mission, I'm going to do it with everything I have. He wasn't crying about the fact that he was dreaming about watches at night. He was expressing that as a simple, normal reaction of what you're involved in during the daytime. But it means he put himself into it. We compare that with another story I heard that Rav Moshe said about that same period in his life. He said, when I was working there in the watchmakers, so they would play music on the radio all the time, and a lot of the music wasn't to my taste. He said, but I learned how to be so into my work that I didn't even notice or it didn't bother me. And that power stayed with me after as well. This isn't simply a mind trick of getting involved in something so that you're focused on one thing, you don't focus on the other. What it is embracing your mission to the extent that you're able to channel all the powers that you have and even to tap into powers beyond what you have, and that gives you the ability to rise above challenges in the surroundings, to rise above what's around you, and to have that sense of identity no matter what you're doing, no matter where you are. Having traveled around a bunch this past week or so, I see how necessary that is, right? It's a person cannot, in most cases, spend their entire life in the rarefied environment of the Beis Medrash, or even in a neighborhood which is, so to speak, an extension of the Beis Medrash. We live in a global world, and we have to go all sorts of places. We have to interact with people, and we have to, on the one hand, be very positive and create a Kiddush Hashem in all the interactions we're having, whether it's from a gas station attendant to the person sitting next to you on a plane to everything else there. On the other hand, sometimes you get shocked by the exposure that you get and the challenges that you face in trying to successfully navigate that world. If a person's on a mission, if you have a sense that I've been sent to this place, I've been sent to this place by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through His Torah, and therefore, this is my mission in life, this is who I am, and this is what I have to do, that enables a person to turn missions that sometimes seem impossible into possible. And because everything that you must do really is your mission, so that means your mission is always possible. So we have to avoid the pitfall of Korach, avoid trying to pick and choose our missions according to standards that aren't the standards of what the Torah is asking. We have to double check always to make sure that the mission we're doing is one that we should be undertaking, right? Is one that makes sense for us, is one that is coming from Torah values, and then we check in the parameters and how to do that mission in the way that the Torah wants us to. And when a person does that, so they're able to accomplish things far beyond what they would be able to do if limited to their very own powers. So this is what I saw in this world of traveling and thinking about the parshas as they accompanied me on this trip. You're on a mission. The mission is possible. And if it's done right, you're able to access those powers that help it be possible, even if it seemed to really be mission impossible.